Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are all working to make this world a better place. Now, I'm thrilled to have as my guest co-host, Dr. Robert Fisher. Now, Robert is a dear friend who I've known since we were both very young. Now, Bob is an assistant clinical professor at UCLA, and he is known as one of the top psychiatrists in the field. He is a founder and former owner of the Optimum Performance Institute. Now, who could be a better fit when we're talking about the brain? Bob, thanks for joining me here on Answers for the Family.
Alan, it's always a pleasure to spend time with you, and particularly on a topic that's of great professional interest as well as personal interest in how one can basically improve the quality of one's life. So I'm really looking forward to this opportunity.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Now, our topic today, for those that haven't gotten our email, and again, you know, if you would like to get information in regards to the show, contact us and give us your email. We'll add you to the mailing list, and you'll have all this information ahead of time. So the topic is genius foods. Now, our guest uncovers the stunning link between our dietary and lifestyle choices and our brain health. It's revealing how the foods you eat directly affect your ability to focus, learn, remember, create, analyze new ideas, and maintain a healthy, balanced mood. Our guest today, Max Lugavel, is a filmmaker, a TV personality, and health and science journalist, as well as a brain food expert. He is also the director of the upcoming film, Breadhead, the first ever documentary about dementia prevention through diet and lifestyle. And he is the author of the soon-to-be-released Genius Foods, Becoming Smarter, Happier, and More Productive While Protecting Your Brain for Life. Now, Mr. Lugavel he's contributed to Medscape, Vice, Fast Company, and The Daily Beast, and he's been a featured speaker on NBC Nightly News, The Dr. Oz Show, and he's been in The Wall Street Journal. He is a very sought-after speaker, and he's been invited to lecture at esteemed academic institutions such as the New York Academy of Science and the Weill Cornell Medicine, and has given keynotes at such events as the Biohacker Summit in Stockholm, Sweden. Max, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan, so much for having me. It's a real treat to be here with you guys.
Well, this is a topic that is now near and dear to my heart. Many of the people who have been listening to the show have noticed sort of a shift over the last couple of years, and I've become a bit of a biohacker myself. And I got into it when my mother was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And at that time, it became a focus on what are the things that we can do. And the more that I got into it, the more I learned that this is something that has been increasing, and it sort of ties right into the way in which we've also altered our diet. So this ties right in regards to what you're doing as far as tying food into it. So share with us a little bit about what got you to the point to where you decided to investigate food and then eventually tie it to brain health.
Absolutely. So I began as a journalist. My first job out of college lasted 5 years. I was one of the main producers and TV personalities and on-camera journalists for a TV network that former Vice President Al Gore founded called Current TV, which was available in 100 million homes nationwide. And working at that network gave me the incredible opportunity to cut my teeth and hone my storytelling abilities, so to speak, with some of the top media professionals in the world. And this includes Peabody Award-winning journalists. And my duties there ranged from telling stories that were lighter in nature to really hard-hitting journalism. In fact, one of the pieces that I did earned me a featured appearance on Anderson Cooper's show on CNN. When I left Current TV to try to figure out where I was going to go with my career, I was in my late 20s at the time. In my personal life, I began spending more and more time in New York City, which is where I'm from, and more time around my mother. And I noticed, and me and my brothers noticed, that it had seemed as if her brain's processing speed had sort of downshifted. She began complaining of memory fog, a brain fog, and cognitive problems. And we also noticed a very subtle change to my mom's gait, meaning the way that she walked. Now, this is not something that went over our heads, because my mother is a very spirited New Yorker. She was 58 at the time, so she wasn't the picture of somebody succumbing to the ravages of aging. She was a very young, youthful, vibrant woman, and suddenly her mental capacity had seemed like when you have a web browser open with too many open tabs, and you're trying to watch a video, and the frame rate starts to stutter. That's what we started witnessing in my mother. And we had no framework for understanding what this was, because I had no prior family history of dementia or any kind of neurological condition. And so it led to me going around the country with my mom to visit some of the best neurology departments that we have in hopes of finding at least a sliver of clarity. We were fortunate enough to be in New York, so we visited NYU, Columbia. We couldn't really find concrete answers in either of those two hospitals, so we went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland. And ultimately, our journey culminated, at least for me, in a trip to the Cleveland Clinic, where my mom, for the first time, was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease. She was prescribed drugs for both Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, even though her symptoms did not fit neatly into either diagnosis. And frankly, in that doctor's office, at the Cleveland Clinic, which is what we might almost consider a cathedral to modern medical scientific research, I experienced there and in other hospitals what I've come to refer to as diagnose and adios. A physician essentially would run a battery of strange cognitive tests on my mom, and at the end, at least in this case, prescribed a couple of biochemical band-aids without addressing diet and lifestyle once. And in fact, it was only later that night in the hotel room, when I had those orange prescription bottles in my hand with labels on them that looked to me like hieroglyphics, that I Googled them. And I realized that my mom had been prescribed drugs for these terrible neurological diseases. And at that point, I essentially had a panic attack. My world sort of, I just remember it was sort of as if you were to spill ink all over a white sheet of paper. I ceased to be able to think about anything else, and I became fixated on understanding to the best of my ability how a woman at 58 coming from a family with no prior history of neurodegenerative disease could develop such a condition. And I began digging into, using my background as a journalist, the primary literature, looking into research trials, observational studies, even animal studies, to try to come to some sort of answer. And my hunch was that diet and lifestyle had something to do with it. My mother's mother, my maternal grandmother, actually at the time, she's no longer with us, but she was 96 and cognitively healthy. So clearly, I mean, it was shocking, to say the least, that my grandmother's cognition was okay, and that my mother was suddenly taking these drugs for diseases which I had previously thought of to be only old person's diseases.
Of the differences that you saw in their lifestyle and in their diet that led you to start to go in that direction?
that's a great question. So, I mean, I guess I knew that something, I had a hunch that something had to have changed between my grandmother's diet and my mom's and lifestyle that had to contribute to what my mom had developed. And so I started looking really at, you know, what it is that we're eating. I went into my mom's kitchen and I started looking around. And my mom, born in the 1950s, was her whole life terrified of heart disease because her father actually had passed of a heart condition. And my mom, at the age of 16, had some kind of congenital defect where she had a surgery and it was fixed. But her whole life, basically as a result, she had been kind of afraid of heart disease. So she was the perfect person to really adhere to the dietary guidelines that were essentially given to her by the powers that were over the course of her lifetime. And so how that manifested was essentially in my house growing up, we always avoided things like saturated fats. We never had any butter in the house, and we always had margarine in those pale yellow tubs. Mm-hmm. By the stove, instead of cooking foods in saturated fats, butter, things like that, we always had a big tub of corn oil. And I never saw my mom eating eggs growing up, but she would eat foods that were low in fat and low in cholesterol with abandon. So growing up, we always had bakery products around. We always had breads and pretzels and packaged foods, potato chips. But as long as there was no saturated fat and no cholesterol, my mom essentially would go to town. I mean, mm-hmm. dinner in my house growing up many nights would consist of some kind of noodle, wheat-based noodle mm-hmm. with margarine. And I started to ask myself if these foods are really as healthy as my mom had previously believed that they were. And when I started doing research into what the brain requires in terms of its optimal function, there was profound cognitive dissonance, to say the least. I started looking at dietary patterns around the world that are associated with reduced risk of neurodegenerative disease. And this is not a secret. Most physicians are aware that the Mediterranean dietary pattern, the kinds of foods, the kinds of diet and lifestyle that they adhere to in the Mediterranean region of the world is associated with better health. Mm-hmm. So I began there. This is a dietary pattern characterized by more vegetables, high consumption of extra virgin olive oil. They don't use corn oil, soybean oil, vegetable oil, any of these industrially processed oils that we've been told for the past couple of decades are good for us. In the Mediterranean region of the world, they cook with extra virgin olive oil. They use it as a sauce. They drench their salads in it. They eat eggs. Mm-hmm. They enjoy fatty cuts of fish. And they also, the Mediterranean dietary pattern, as it's presently defined in the medical literature, also includes grains and grain products. But I started to ask myself from an evolutionary perspective what the brain might need to thrive and to really sort of come to answers, or at least to form a hypothesis to guide my investigation. I started to look at what kinds of foods we had for the vast majority of our time here on Earth and what foods only appeared in our diets until relatively recently. And I realized that though the Mediterranean diet includes grains, grains have only been in the human diet for a blip on the timescale of the modern anatomical human. Mm-hmm. And I started to look into whether or not grains actually improve health, and I realized that there's actually no solid evidence to say that grains improve health. And in fact, I stumbled upon a really interesting insight that links Alzheimer's disease with diabetes. So today, we know that 50% of the U.S. population is either diabetic or pre-diabetic. And if you have type 2 diabetes, you have anywhere between a 2- and 4-fold increased risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And so that to me was a very powerful insight. And I put all of these together to try to come up with a dietary pattern that might actually improve the health of the body, the metabolic health of the body. And that's sort of what I describe in the book Genius Foods.
Well, you have touched on some things that are so not only fascinating, but right on target as far as I'm concerned. Now, have you gone also into a little more detail in regards, or I don't know if the book does, but how this is affecting our mitochondria? So, you know, we're talking about how it's affecting our cells, but is it going deeper to the point in which it's affecting our mitochondria, which is then keeping them from communicating with other cells that can even help them protect themselves from these either viruses or diseases?
Yeah. Alan, that's a great question. And, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about mitochondria. Mitochondria are certainly important. They're the power plants to our cells. So all of the energy that your brain cells need to help you to seize the day and to do all of the things that you love rely on mitochondria. But just to take a step backwards, you know, mitochondria are organelles. So they're located within the cell. But over the course of writing Genius Foods, one of the discoveries that I made that really, I think, guided how I approached the subject and my recommendations in the book. You see, for nutrients and fuels to get to mitochondria, they have to be able to enter the cell. And the boundary of every cell is called the cell membrane. And the cell membrane basically serves as the skin of the cell that separates the interior contents of the cell from what is outside of the cell, and it aids in the transport of nutrients and fuels into the cell, and it also keeps toxins out of the cell. So I began looking at how to keep the cell membrane healthy and functioning at its most optimal, because that really, I mean, to talk about mitochondria without talking about the cell membrane puts the cart before the horse.
Okay.
So I started looking at fats and the kinds of fats that we're eating in our diets and what kinds of fats we really need to consume that promote supple, fluid cell membranes. So a healthily functioning neuronal cell membrane has to possess the property of fluidity. So if you think about, you know, this border that basically protects the interior contents of the cell, but selectively lets nutrients and fuels to enter it, there are various receptors that lie underneath the cell surface that are essentially the ears of the cell that need to bob up to the surface in order to hear the messages that the cell is basically sent. Some of these messages are sent by neurotransmitters. So when we think about healthy brain function, we think about neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, which is involved in feeling reward. Serotonin is involved in mood, but it's also heavily involved in executive function. And then there's a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine, which is involved in memory and learning and attention. And this is one of the neurotransmitters that's actually involved in Alzheimer's disease. And so I realized that, you know, the standard American diet has become awash in a certain type of fat called omega-6 fats. Mm-hmm. Omega-6 fats are really important to brain health. In fact, in the hunter-gatherer diet, it's believed that we consume these omega-6 fats in a ratio with omega-3 fats in a proportion of about 1:1. But today we overconsume omega-6 fats, which creates essentially rigidity of the cell membrane, which impairs the receptors of these neurons, the ability to bob up to the surface and receive outside messages. So to me, the most important thing to do is to really look at the fats that you're consuming and make sure that you're not consuming an overabundance of omega-6 fats, and instead make sure that you're getting an adequate amount of healthy omega-3 fats from fatty fish, salmon, mackerel, herring, sardines, things like that, and to avoid polyunsaturated grain and seed oils that are rich in omega-6 fats, like canola oil, soybean oil, and corn oil, for example. And by doing so, you're actually also going to be helping your cell mitochondria directly and indirectly, but essentially in the context of these neuronal cell membranes, you're going to help fuel more effectively get to that mitochondria, which are, again, the power plants of your cells.
Yeah, I know, and you're mentioning fuel, and first of all, yes, I completely agree that they need to be able to communicate with the rest of the body, and from the standpoint of fuel, you know, I know that we need fats, and that I think that we've gotten to this point where people believe that they have to remove fat out of everything. You know, they have to remove carbs. They have to remove all of these things. And yet the fat is actually what's giving us the energy. And without the energy, they're not communicating. And without communicating, you know, is that now causing part of this breakdown?
Yeah. I mean, there is a global energy crisis, and it has nothing to do with gasoline and everything to do with our brain health. So the brain is the most energy-hungry organ in the body. In fact, 25% of everything that you eat and all of the air that you, 25% of the every breath you take goes to create energy in your brain cells, in these mitochondria. And the brain has two fuels that it can use. Two predominant fuels. One is glucose, which in the standard American diet is the predominant fuel that the brain will use, because your average American today consumes about 300 grams of carbohydrates per day. So that is a constant glut of glucose that the brain will use to generate energy. The problem is the brain is like the universe's most advanced hybrid car, and glucose can be analogous to gasoline in a hybrid car, for example. But the electricity, the clean-burning fuel, is actually fat. The brain loves to use fat for fuel. In fact, I consider fat our brain's birthright fuel. You see, when a human baby is born, a baby comes packaged with an abundance of fat to fuel its developing brain. This is because a human baby continues its cognitive development out in the real world. This is what some refer to as the fourth trimester. But today, our ability to use fat for fuel is shunted by the fact that our diets have become saturated with carbohydrates. But by consuming a diet that is higher in fat and lower in carbohydrates, this allows your brain to use fat for fuel in the form of ketones. So the brain can't directly use fat for fuel, but your liver has no problem converting fats to ketones, particularly in the context of a low-carbohydrate diet. And so by allowing your brain to use fat for fuel instead of glucose, you're essentially creating more energy with less collateral damage. Because like gasoline, one of the byproducts of glucose metabolism is waste. But a lot less waste is generated when fat is being used for fuel by the brain than when glucose is being used for fuel by the brain. And how this all adds up to reduced risk for developing diseases like Alzheimer's disease, it's not yet fully certain, but there are some very interesting trials that have been published recently using diets that allow the brain to use fat for fuel in the context of Alzheimer's disease, patients that have already been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and also a form of cognitive impairment called mild cognitive impairment, which is often considered pre-dementia. And it's been shown in these small trials that a ketogenic dietary intervention, meaning a diet that allows the brain to run on fat instead of carbs, actually has been shown to improve cognitive function in patients with mild Alzheimer's disease. So to me, this is very hopeful news, and it certainly warrants further research before we can make any definitive conclusions. But from an evolutionary sense and from a brain energetic sense, it makes perfect sense to me. And these are all the things that, I'm hopeful for future research. But I think that the current state of research is very empowering nonetheless. And it's I go to great lengths to detail it and detail it accurately and responsibly in Genius Foods.
Well, I think the $64 question here then is, at a time in which our country is in a huge healthcare crisis, why is it that our government continues to allow the manufacturers of these products to continue to put that out there and is not helping to get this information that you're providing right now out to all of its citizens?
I mean, that's such an important question. You know, if you were to look at the total planted landmass of the United States, 65% of the planted landmass in the U.S. is given to wheat, corn, and soy. 5% is dedicated to growing vegetables. So when somebody comes out and says that, you know, these exact kinds of foods that we've dedicated so much of our landmass to growing, and of course, not to forget about all of the financial subsidies given to growers of these exact kinds of products, it makes sense that the, you know, the economic system as it's currently set up and the food system wouldn't be too fond of my message, you know, as it pertains to reducing our dependence on grains like wheat, corn, and soy, and consuming more vegetables, which is ironic because 90% of Americans today are deficient in at least one essential vitamin or mineral. And this is exactly why when you go to the supermarket and you look at all of the packaged foods that line the supermarket shelves, you'll notice that they're all enriched with various vitamins and nutrients. But these are essentially synthetic vitamins that are added to these ultra-processed foods. It's the dietary equivalent of putting lipstick on a pig. But when you look at vegetables, which are, you know, they're, first of all, they don't contribute to the massive rates of type 2 diabetes and obesity that we're seeing in this country. We know that not enough Americans are consuming vegetables. And the incredible amount of micronutrients that they contain, to me, it's a no-brainer, no pun intended, that these should really be making up the bulk of our diets. Yeah, you know, I think this is something that it's a systemic problem. And my role, I feel, is really to help give people the information and give it to them in an accessible and approachable way so that at least it's informed consent when they choose to buy some of these products that we're talking about, for example. I always say that, you know, my role is not, especially, you know, coming from a background in journalism. I don't have a medical degree. It's not to provide advice. It's to provide information that is accessible and exciting and that instills hope, because, you know, I know that not all people, certainly many people today, are interested in ways to prevent things like Alzheimer's disease and dementia, with rates expected to triple in the coming years. I mean, there are currently 10 million people walking in the United States at least that are at risk.
You know, Max,
you know, I think not everybody's necessarily tuned into dementia-related content. So my goal is really to make it exciting and accessible for all people, and to really package this in terms of brain performance, which is related to neuroprotective diets as well.
You know, Max, this is Bob Fisher calling, and calling. you know, Max, I do have an MD, but yet the information that you provide is very necessary. And there are some issues within the healthcare delivery system, particularly in our system, about fragmentation, meaning the urologist speaking with the cardiologist. You know, the diet may be good for the heart, not good, as good, or as efficient. I think your term efficiency is very interesting for the brain. But the bottom line is you also make some references to evolution. And certainly in psychiatry and throughout the world now, the issue is one of brain function and consciousness. And that's a very big, for me, area of exploration. And there, for 1,000 years, there have been different systems, particularly yoga, that really focuses on diet. And I guess a basic fundamental question is regarding a vegetarian diet. Then you move from vegetarian to vegan, et cetera, the issue of proteins. I mean, how necessary is protein? And when you talk about, I think you're exactly right on the money when you talk about cell membranes. And you know, basically a conceptual model is cell membranes are semi-permeable, meaning it lets some stuff through, doesn't let other stuff through, and that's the essence, I think, of what you're talking about in terms of flexibility. So please comment on the yoga system of diet and the evolutionary, and as we evolve, as consciousness evolves, from your vantage point, please talk about vegetarian and diets and what helps, what really helps.
Well, yeah, so it's a very important question. You know, I get asked a lot about the place of animal products in a brain optimal diet. You know, researchers speculate that it's not just that access to meat and the essential fatty acids that are contained in wild animal fat, that actually helped catalyze the growth of our brains. Not only that, but the invention of fire played a huge role in that, and our ability to cook meat actually allowed this explosion of both nutrient and caloric density that helped really grow our brains into what they are today. I think people in the nutrition field, there's a lot of zealotry I've experienced, and people tend to identify with their diet so strongly that for some people it's almost like a religion, and people want to think in terms of black and whites. And the reality is that in science there are very few black and whites, and there's no such thing as a one size fits all diet. Everybody's different. We all have different genes, we have different genders, we have different fitness levels. But I'm pretty certain from the research that I've done that some meat, especially in the form of properly raised grass-fed beef, for example, pasture-raised eggs, wild salmon, I think these are very important to the growing, to the developing brain. And I say developing sort of jokingly in terms of the evolutionary sense, but since the mid-90s, we now know that the adult brain continues to change all throughout life. This is called neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. We used to think that the brain was fixed by the mid-20s, only to begin a long, slow decline up until life. Bob, you know this, but now we know that there are regions of the brain that have been demonstrated to have the ability of neurogenesis. And so by supplying the brain with these important nutrients throughout life, I think this has become so critically important. You mentioned protein. So protein is definitely an important part of the conversation, but I think too often it becomes the only part of the conversation that people really talk about. They're like, well, you don't need to eat animal products to get protein. You can mix and match various grains and legumes to get complete protein, but not many in the United States are protein deficient. So I think it's really important to broaden the conversation out beyond protein and talk about other nutrients that are contained in meat that are really important to the brain. So preformed EPA and DHA fat. DHA fat, which is found in the fat of wild salmon, for example, is one of the brain's most important building blocks. And it's really important to get these fats in their preformed state in animal products. Those don't exist in plant foods. In plant foods, you only get short-chain versions called ALA, it's an abbreviation, and our bodies are very inefficient at converting ALA from flaxseed or chia seeds, for example, into their usable forms in the body. So I think it's very important to get these kinds of fats from animal foods. Aside from DHA fat, there are a whole host of nutrients that some of which we recognize and some of which we have yet to recognize that are considered conditionally essential. So you might not develop a deficiency disease by not eating them, but your brain is going to work better when you have more of these conditionally essential nutrients in your diet. One example of that I talk about in the book Genius Foods is a nutrient called creatine. Creatine is found in grass-fed beef. It's found in certain fish. People that work out a lot are very familiar with creatine because it's a very popular sports supplement with a robust efficacy and safety record. But creatine is also naturally manufactured in our bodies, and it's vital for proper brain function. And they've done randomized controlled trials where they look at vegans and vegetarians as compared to omnivores, and they found that when supplementing with creatine, which is just one of the nutrients that one researcher somewhere found the budget to study, they found that when supplementing with this nutrient, the cognitive performance of these vegans and vegetarians actually improved. And so, you know, we could go on and on, but essentially what that means is, you know, we've co-evolved with our food, right? And I think, as you mentioned, medicine tends to take this reductionist approach, and that happens in nutrition as well. Michael Pollan coined the term nutritionism to basically describe the fact that, you know, nutrition scientists love to distill foods into their requisite nutrients and then study those nutrients. And I think that's vitally important, don't get me wrong, but I think what gets lost when we try to apply those findings to our diets and our lifestyles is that we forget that we've evolved with food, which contains nutrients that we have names for, and many that we don't even yet have names for. Mm-hmm. So that's why it becomes, I think, so important from a cognitive and brain health standpoint, and just an overall body health standpoint, to not cut entire food groups out of your diet, particularly when we've had those food groups for such a long time in the evolutionary sense, in our, you know, as Homo sapiens.
Well, yes, and especially if we're replacing them with a whole bunch of words that most of us can't pronounce.
Yeah.
So for everybody listening, okay, our guest today is Max Lugavere. The book is Genius Foods, Become Smarter, Happier, and More Productive While Protecting Your Brain for Life. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. My guest co-host is Dr. Robert Fisher. Our guest is Max Lugavere. And we are talking about your brain health. Kind of bottom line, it's your brain health. And Max, we do have some questions that have come in either through the internet or through a variety of different channels that come in. This one reads, I am an assistant principal at a private school, and we have witnessed an increase in ADD and ADHD among our students. I'm convinced that diet is one of the major reasons, so a few of us are working with parents to research and create complementary and healthier menus for school and home. I was so excited to see your summary on the Answers website, and I wanted to ask the question, do you have any different or special recommendations of foods or diets specifically for children? And this is from Monroe in New Jersey.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, when we talk about conditions which absolutely are increasing in terms of their diagnoses today, like ADHD, you know, these are conditions that essentially involve neurotransmitters. In the case of ADHD, it's dopamine and norepinephrine in particular. And it goes back to helping facilitate healthy fluid neuronal membranes, for one. I also tend to think that ADHD might be a modern problem. You know, as hunter-gatherers, a member of our species had to be self-sufficient, right? Today, and ever since the first agricultural revolution, we became a culture that really valued specialization. Hunter-gatherer needed to be able to do everything himself. But a post-agricultural human really had to, you know, we favored specialized education. There had to be somebody to grow the wheat, somebody to pick it, somebody to cook it, somebody to sell it, essentially. And so there's this theory that fitting an ancient brain into the requirements of the modern world might be like fitting a square peg into a round hole, so to speak. And this is why you see an overwhelming proportion of people with ADHD in more entrepreneurial careers, because it allows them to really take on a broader array of tasks. And I certainly struggled with, you know, attention and focus all throughout my schooling, which I think in some way is what has led me to write this book. But I do talk about the fact that omega-3s, which again promote more fluid cell membranes, tend to help. And there's a small number of trials that have shown that omega-3 supplementation can actually help in scores of attention with both children with ADHD as well as children that that have not been diagnosed. And there is also a relationship between omega-6 consumption and worse scores of attention. So I document this actually in Genius Foods in Chapter 2. And, you know, as my own sort of N of one anecdotal experiments, I can attest to the fact that since I really began researching the book and started putting these practices into play in my own diet and lifestyle, that my ability to focus, pay attention, tune out distraction has certainly improved as well. You know, the role of diet in these sorts of things is definitely an area that is under hot pursuit by researchers. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that as we await some sort of consensus statement when it comes to diet and helping children, our children make healthier choices, I think there's no question but to act, especially when it's as simple as, you know, removing the hyper-processed foods, the Pop-Tarts, the cereals, and things like that, and adding back in foods that are high in omega-3s, lower in omega-6 fats, and contain the kinds of micronutrients that the brain requires to thrive.
You know,
great question.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a the other issue that I think is people pay a lot more attention to, which is weight loss. So here we have something we're talking about the brain. It is the thing that controls the rest of our body. And I know that as a country, we spend, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars on weight loss. So share a little bit about, you know, those things that they can do that's helping their brain, and it's going to give them weight loss also.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, there's actually an inverse relationship between the size of your waist and the size of your brain. The same factors that will put a person at increased risk for obesity. And we now know that 66% of the United States population is either overweight or obese. Also seem to wreak havoc on proper cognitive function. And so, yeah, in my book, I highlight if your goal is weight loss, I mean, there's a lot in the book that you'll be able to get. I highlight a form of fat loss that's now being called biochemical liposuction by some researchers for its ability to allow for fat oxidation, which, again, is good for our waistlines. But, I mean, what I'm so excited about is the brain partakes in this party as well. Because the brain loves to use fat for fuel. I mean, the fat that we have sitting around our waistlines is essentially like a spare battery pack for our brain. The problem is today in the standard American diet, the fact that, you know, we have less leisure time recreational activity than ever before. We're eating 300 grams of carbohydrates per day. Essentially, we're denying our brains the ability from liquidating that fat. Which is unfortunate. I think for people that are listening that really want to lose weight, I mean, calories do count. But I think once we start adopting a diet that brings back whole foods to the table, foods without ingredient labels, I think most people will watch the weight fall off fairly effortlessly. You know, the food supply today has become awash in what are called hyper-palatable products. A lot of the most processed foods that line our supermarket aisles that now make up the bulk of American calories being consumed basically usually combine flavors and mouthfeels that push the brain to a bliss point beyond which self-control becomes futile. So we tend to think of it as being a moral failure when we go through that entire pint of ice cream or when we eat the bag of chips when we only intended to have one or two. But really, these foods are designed to be over-consumed. They're hyper-palatable. It's sort of like pornography for the mouth. But I think by alerting people to this and letting them know that it's not a moral failure, these foods are designed, your brain, you're hardwired to want to over-consume these foods, it'll help people keep them out of the shopping cart. And if there's a food in your shopping cart, it's as good as in your stomach. And instead, you know, natural whole foods, they're a lot less prone to overconsumption. And I think when we base our diet around those foods, you don't even need to calorie count because you'll inadvertently end up consuming less calories if weight loss is in fact your goal.
Yeah, you know, and I think you bring up a great point because I think what people need to realize, and there are people that have worked in the food industry that have left the food industry, and they said one of the reasons why they left was because they learned that their job was to bioengineer this food in such a way that people would continue to eat it, and as you said, to overindulge in it, and that it's specifically being bioengineered specifically for that purpose. But I love the fact that some of the people that have come out are people that have left these companies and said, that's why I left. I couldn't do that anymore because I felt I was contributing to the problem rather than the solution.
Max,
I'm
sorry. Yeah, Max, you know, I have a question. I mean, from the research that you've done, and you've done it extensively, what are the worst things that one can eat regarding brain health?
Great question, Bob. I would say the worst things include processed, refined carbohydrates, ultra-processed, hyper-palatable foods. These foods are, they drive overconsumption. They stimulate insulin, which is an ancestral hormone that is not bad, but today it's become chronically elevated, and 40% of Alzheimer's cases might be owed to chronically elevated insulin alone. Aside from those foods, I would say the grain and seed oils that we've been told for decades are a better alternative to butter, when in fact they are not. So canola oil, corn oil, soybean oil, grapeseed oil, rapeseed oil, these oils are all highly processed. If you look at grapeseed oil, for example, grapeseed oil it's a byproduct of winemaking. It's harvested from the seeds of grapes. It used to be a throwaway product until one industrious manufacturer decided that they could basically extract this oil and sell it. Very damaging to our health, full of omega-6 fats. I mean, we were talking a bit earlier about the balance between omega-6 fats and omega-3 fats being very important for neuronal membrane function. Grapeseed oil has an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio of about 700 to 1, so very damaging. And these oils also inadvertently, over the course of the production process, develop trans fats, which we know are associated with an increased risk in early mortality. So I would say skim these foods off the top. Ideally, you want to stick to foods that are that don't have ingredients labels, with a few exceptions, but I would say that those are the most offensive foods in the modern food supply, for sure.
Max,
and then in the book Genius Foods, we have a full shopping guide, and we highlight the foods that are actually that there exists strong evidence base to show that they actually have nutrients and compounds that actually promote optimal brain function.
Now, Max, unfortunately, we are about out of time. We've got about 30 seconds. But what is the top thing that everyone can do to help their brain health? If you could give everybody one thing, if you said, look, you're driving down the road today, there's one thing that you need to change, what is that one thing that they can do to start helping their brain today?
I would say be more physically active, and I'm going to give you a bonus one. So exercise. And then eat a large salad every single day.
There we go.
You set that as a rule for yourself.
All right, Max. Well, thank you so much. The time has just flown by. I believe that you also have a home here in Los Angeles. Let's stay in touch. I'd love to have you come back in anytime. You come in studio, and if you have another book that's being launched or anything that you want to come in and talk about, let me know. We'll have you come in as the guest co-host. So thank you so much for your time, and I just really want to acknowledge the fact that you are really on the front line now of getting information out there to people, and I love the fact that you're using multiple mediums to do it. So I think that's the way that we're going to get more of the information out, because we certainly can't count on either the large corporations or the government to get the information to us quick enough.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. Thank you, Bob. It's been a real honor to be here with you guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Now, for everybody out there, please be sure to put on your calendar and tune in next Monday when our guest will be bringing us information from the HeartMath Institute to discuss the science of the heart, exploring the role of the heart in human performance. And please, if you get a chance, visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us, and it will help get the information out to other people. Now, for those that were listening to this show and you want to get more information, if you weren't able to write anything down, if you're out there driving, you can always go to our site at answersforthefamily.com. We will have all of the information there. If you want to try to get a hold of Max, you can go to www.maxlugavere.com. That's LUGAVERE.com. The book is Genius Foods. So for everybody out there, and Bob, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. Know that you're welcome anytime.
Thank you, Alan.
All right. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.